This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture, with me, Neil Denny. This week, journalist Gaia Vince takes a journey to the heart of the planet we made in her book, Adventures in the Anthropocene. Gaia Vince is a journalist and broadcaster specialising in science and the environment. She's been the news editor of Nature and the online editor of The New Scientist. Her work has appeared in The Guardian, The Times, Science, Scientific American, Australian Geographic and The Australian. And she has a regular column, Smart Planet, on BBC Online and devises and presents programmes about the Anthropocene for BBC Radio. Her first book is Adventures in the Anthropocene, A Journey to the Heart of the Planet We Made. Gaia, welcome to Little Atoms.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So I've said twice in that introduction the term Anthropocene, so we're going to begin by talking about what that means.
So this is a big fundamental concept, essentially. What we're saying is, with the Anthropocene, what it actually means is the age of humans. Mm-hmm. So it's a geological term, essentially. If you look back over the periods, the epochs, the eras that have gone before, we're familiar with the Jurassic, the Cretaceous, the famous times that have gone before. And what we're saying now is that we're living in a new period, a new era, essentially, which is called the Anthropocene. What we're officially living in is the Holocene. So if you were to look up in an encyclopedia, where are we now? You would find we were living in the Holocene. But scientists are saying that we are so changing our planet that we've pushed it beyond the Holocene now. We're now living in this new era, and it's defined by us because we're the biggest change. We're the biggest change makers on the planet. So it's the age of humans.
When we look at one of those, other, the Triassic or the Jurassic, there's no obvious distinct. We can't say Triassic started on a Tuesday at this point 500 billion years ago or whatever. And the Anthropocene is the same, isn't it? There's debate over when it actually began.
Well, yes. I mean, normally that period spans thousands of years. I mean, there was a very sudden impact when a meteor hit the Earth and wiped out the dinosaurs that marked the end of one era and the beginning of another. But that's kind of unusual. Actually, it takes thousands of years. But we're in this really odd situation where we're kind of living through the journey between the Holocene and the Anthropocene. And it's only with the passage of time that we'll be able to look back in thousands, perhaps millions of years, and see where that stripe in the rock is that marks our human influence. And then geologists will be able to say that's where the Anthropocene started. But we're in this really strange position now of trying to decide where does this era start? Because if we're going to call it the Anthropocene, well, you know, geologists, we all love labels. We all want to put our mark there. For geology, it's called the golden spike. It's this real spike that they put in a rock to say this is where one period starts and another finishes. So if we're going to mark this age, we do have to decide when it started and when it finished. And that does put us in a bit of a problem, because generally the beginning and ends of ages are marked because sediments have accumulated, become solidified and turned to rock, and then they mark this difference, this band in the rock. But obviously that hasn't had time to happen yet. We're talking about, you know, maybe 50, maybe 150 years ago or whatever. We're making this very arbitrary decision, essentially. So what scientists will probably do is either come up with a date, or they will come up with a chemical signature or a radioactive signature. So so one idea is at the end of the Second World War, there were the atomic tests. That's the first time that we have this marker for radioactive cesium, for example. So so the golden spike might be radioactive cesium.
And well, I was going to say, what would this, to archaeologists in the distant future, what would the line look like, the sort of layer, even if it's incredibly, you know, minutely thin? And you just mentioned there, so it could be literally a layer of radioactivity, basically.
Yeah, so, I mean, cesium's found everywhere across the planet, but it's particularly accumulated in lake beds, the sediments building up there. So, for example, in the Great Lakes in the United States. But there are other ideas as well. You know, if we look at the sudden injection that we've made, that humans have made, of carbon dioxide, that's from fossil fuels. So that's actually a different isotope of carbon dioxide that would be around naturally. It's carbon 12 rather than 13. So we've got a different percentage, if you like, of carbon in the atmosphere. Mm. And that's another way of looking at it. We don't know yet how thick this band is going to be in the rocks, because mm-hmm. we don't know how long the Anthropocene will last. You know, I mean, we could be wiped out by an asteroid like mm-hmm. the dinosaurs tomorrow, or we could wipe ourselves out in some horrific epidemic, or because we run out of food, mm. or in various ways, the Anthropocene could end very soon, or, you know, we might survive for thousands, if not maybe million years. And we're a very young species, it's really hard to tell. So we don't know how thick that band is going to be. Mm-hmm. But what is very clear, geologists say, is that we have already left our mark. We have left this indelible print. We've created completely novel compounds, you know, from concrete to plastics, PCB is everywhere, mm-hmm. to the radioactive materials. Where our cities are, we've got an entire landscape, an artificial landscape that's just made of glass, concrete, steel, aluminium. Aluminium doesn't occur naturally, you know, mm-hmm. we make it. So all these different things, and in so many ways, we are leaving our mark. This is now beyond debate. The Anthropocene title that we give it mm-hmm. is being decided in 2016 by the International Stratigraphy Community. They're the people that actually decide these things, mm-hmm. the group of geologists. But it's not under debate whether or not we are leaving our mark. I think that's clear enough. People are already seeing that. There's very many examples of that.
I want to talk to you about how you would describe what the book is about then, because, I mean, I guess Adventures in the Anthropocene, it's not just looking at travelling around, looking at the human-made planet, but it is almost a elegiac, you know, looking at ways in which we might be hastening the end of this era.
Well, I mean, it is looking at the way humans are changing the planet, this phenomenal change that's going on at the moment. But because we are not dinosaurs and we're not meteors, you know, we are actually very complex, mm-hmm. thinking, sentient beings. That makes things a lot more complicated, because we can't measure by using physics. We can't measure what our impact will be and how this will turn out and how everybody is going to live or die. We can't work that out purely on those ways. We have to look at what it means to be human. Mm-hmm. We have to look at the social impact, the social determinants that are pushing us into these different ways, for everything from economics to psychology to governance to the way we live in communities. Mm-hmm. And we're incredibly diverse. So more than half the population now lives in cities, but in 1800, just 3% did. Mm-hmm. So we're undergoing this massive demographic shift, but at the same time, around the world, the people that are experiencing the fastest and most dramatic changes to their landscape and to their ways of life are the people living in the poor world. So these people live in villages, they still farm, they still live very close to the land. I mean, my ancestors have lived in a city for several generations now, so the way that we live hasn't changed that much. Mm-hmm. But these people are undergoing this massive shift, and it's their massive shift, mm-hmm. actually, which is driving the Anthropocene to a large extent. And so that's kind of what I wanted to explore. And I also wanted to see how people are responding to this changed Earth, this new age that we're living in, and have a look at whether it's going to be good, whether it's going to be bad, and how we can turn it around to make sure that enough of us live, as many as possible live in comfort with enough food, water, energy and other resources in a planet where such things are limited. And we have to recognise they are limited now.
And you've just mentioned that not much more than 100 years ago, only 3% of the population lived in cities. Well, it sounds amazing, but that is also history in terms of the fact that nobody is alive that was alive then, so it's still unimaginably long ago to everybody alive on the planet now. But time and time again in the book, you do meet people. Again, a theme seems to build that you're meeting people who can remember, when I was a lad, there was this glacier here and now it's 14 kilometres away or something, or this forest was here. You know, you are constantly meeting people who have seen massive changes in their own lifespan.
So the last 50 years has been the most dramatic change. I mean, it's called the Great Acceleration, mm-hmm. and it has been this huge, phenomenal acceleration in change, in planetary change. And that's within the lifespan of several, mm-hmm. you know, of several of the people I speak to in the books, and within the lifetime almost of me, but certainly of my parents. And it's a generation that's around, can remember, and has watched it massively change. And I think that's actually, it is really important, as you say, it's really important to get that first-hand account of how very, very different it is, because we can all look back and we can all read about how things were different, about how, you know, in my grandparents' time, there were horse-pulled carts in the street. I mean, in a lot of parts of the world, that's still going on, you know. But to meet people whose landscapes have utterly changed, but who depend and who culturally and traditionally for generations before have depended on a landscape that's different, on the Holocene, essentially. I mean, we've evolved into the Holocene. For the few of us that live in the rich Western world, it's you know, we've had a bit of a longer time to grow accustomed to the changes. But for most people, they are living much more closely with a Holocene lifestyle. And we still, you know, we still live, even in London or New York or wherever, we live in a Holocene mentality. You know, we live lives and our institutions and the way we produce food, the way we shop, the way we do everything is based on this Holocene mentality of a low population, plentiful resources, where we can treat the atmosphere and the ocean essentially as our sewers, because they're infinitesimally large, and so we can just throw whatever we want at them and that will be dealt with. Well, things have changed, you know. In the Anthropocene, now we're producing so much of things that don't get degraded naturally. They don't biodegrade, or they don't degrade in a reasonably short timescale. And we are this enormous population now, and resources are limited. We are running out of things. So, I mean, essentially everywhere, all across the world, we're not geared up yet psychologically for the Anthropocene. It does take this kind of mental gear shift to realise that we have to rethink everything, just as people now are doing, you know, in the small village where their glacier, say, has disappeared. I like to think of it a little bit as the Aborigines who are living on Australia suddenly were confronted by the first fleet who arrived. They had sail power, they had all these modern technologies. And so the Aborigines had to decide what they were going to do about that. I mean, they didn't obviously get much of a choice, unfortunately. But this kind of step change in culture and the step change in realising that everything has changed was very sudden there. And we have the same situation now. We have to do that. But there's nobody coming, essentially, from a different culture to tell us how to do it better. We have to work it out ourselves. And that's what makes it so challenging, I suppose.
I'm Alex Cox, and this is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
This is it's lots of things, but one of the aspects of it is it's a travel book. It's a globe-trotting journey that you take. So before we get into the book, I just want to spend some time talking about logistics. How did the opportunity for the book come about, and then how did you decide where to go? Tell us something about the actual, you know, the nuts and bolts of the travel.
Well, so I left my job to explore, basically, and see what was going on out there. I bought a one-way ticket to Kathmandu because I heard about this really incredible guy that was living in Nepal in the mountains and was connecting them using a home Wi-Fi kit, which just sounded incredible to me. So I wanted to meet him and have a look. And that was the way it went, really. I rented out my house for 6 months thinking, you know, it might work, it might not. I got a regular column with an American magazine. And I thought, well, that's going to just pay the bills. I'll see if I can get it going for 6 months. And then after 6 months, we extended the lease and continued. And I basically just freelanced my way around. So because of that, I mean, journalist fees, not brilliant. So it was the most basic trip, you know. It was just buses everywhere. It was hitchhiking. It was staying in god-awful places. Like, we stayed in a brothel one night, dorms in youth hostels. I mean, it was done really basically. Homestays, all that sort of thing. I mean, the trip ended up being 2.5 years. And then I did little bits after that to see things to add to my book. But I think if I was to do it again, I'd want to do it with a bit more money, because it was kind of, yeah. I mean, there's no glamour in really cheap travel. It's really uncomfortable. I've got every disease going. Yeah.
Let's get into the book. So the book it's split into chapters, wherein you sort of take the theme of a type, I guess, a geographical feature. And we'll go through in the next few parts of the show, we're going to look at some of those aspects in more detail. But let's start off talking about, in the first chapter, you look at the atmosphere. And this is interesting because the atmosphere, you know, the warming of the atmosphere is something that obviously links pretty much every other chapter in the book. There's no escaping from the fact that this all-encompassing atmosphere has an effect on all of the other aspects. So, well, let's talk about what's going on with the atmosphere.
Yes, well, you know, you may have heard of global warming, climate change. But yeah, this is one of the biggest and most defining elements of our time. This big shift in climate. I mean, we were talking earlier about the Jurassic and about previous geological ages. A lot of them are defined by their climate. Mm-hmm. They're either very, very warm or very, very cold. They're either ice ages or places of deserts, or it's the atmosphere is very warm and sticky. I mean, we are undergoing an incredible climate change at the moment, which it's kind of hard to get your head around in a lot of ways, because it might not feel warmer every day, but actually the amount of carbon dioxide we're putting in the atmosphere mm-hmm. is very likely to be the fastest rate of change, fastest acceleration in 65 million years. I mean, that's really quite incredible. And carbon dioxide is a gas which is, it's invisible to visible light, so we can see through it. We can't see mm-hmm. carbon dioxide. But it's opaque to infrared. So what it does is it traps heat in the atmosphere. And heat trapped in the atmosphere then warms the surface of the Earth, but it also warms the surface of the oceans. Mm-hmm. And all that heat gets distributed around. And it's an enormous amount of energy that's trapped there. And that energy, that new energy input, affects various things. So one of the effects of this energy imbalance is extreme weather, and we're experiencing that already. We're having a massive hike in extreme weather events, and that affects people, of course, because we're quite coastal. We live on coasts, mm-hmm. and we live in river deltas. That's where civilization started. So these extreme weather events lead to more flooding, they lead to bigger coastal erosion, they lead to crop failures. And ultimately, even though we think we can just go to the supermarket and there'll be food there, that food's going to go up in price, and it's already going up in price. And that has a trickle-down effect on everything, because food is the necessity that we can't live without. So we're living at this very extreme time, and it's having some other strange effects. So the warmer temperatures mean that mountain ecosystems are changing, for example. So mountains are quite interesting because they have, normally, if you want to experience a different temperature, you have to go up or down in latitude. So if you go to the Arctic, it's very cold. If you go to the equator, it's very hot, mm-hmm. and vice versa. But if you go up a mountain, you can experience those dramatic temperature changes mm-hmm. just because of the altitude you're going at. And this is changing as well. So normally, what used to happen is that in the tropics or wherever you have mountains, there would be snow and ice at the top mm-hmm. because they're much colder. But that's actually melting now. So these big glacier stores, this store of free fresh water, is disappearing, which is affecting everything, ecosystems. Mm-hmm. The other thing with temperature changes, actually, is that crops that used to only grow below a certain altitude are growing further up. So there used to be the so-called tree line, mm-hmm. which was this very, very visible line of where vegetation could sort of creep above or below. And now that's blurring. That's becoming much, much more different. And because of the extreme temperatures now, we're getting a lot more forest fires. So a lot of these mountains are very dry. They can be desert-like because precipitation only falls on one flank of the mountain mm-hmm. because of the way clouds go across them and so on. And so they're prey to forest fires now. And that's changing the way people live. It's changing the kinds of animals that live there. It's changing how people farm and whether or not they live on mountains. And a lot of people can no longer live on mountains and they have to migrate to cities or downland, because there's just not enough water. That's the biggest problem with mountains.
The atmosphere is, it's so just unimaginably big that people often have trouble believing that we could have had an effect. But interestingly, a concept that comes up time and time through the book, it's linked in a lot of the chapters, but I want to talk about the actual concept now, is a way in which we could, in another way, affect something as huge as the atmosphere. I'm talking about the concept of geoengineering. So ways in which we could artificially put things in the atmosphere to change the weather in localised places and stuff. It's an amazing idea. Obviously, in lots of ways, quite quite controversial, but is this something that's going to... Well, tell us what geoengineering is, first of all, and then we'll talk about its uses.
To a certain extent, we are already geoengineering. Mm-hmm. We are engineering the planet to make it different. So we're already geoengineering the atmosphere mm-hmm. to make it warmer. We've put off the next ice age, which, you know, we were heading towards another ice age very slowly. That's now, postponed. I mean, that's not going to happen. So we're already geoengineering the planet. And the problem is, this global warming situation is actually putting a lot of people's lives in danger. A lot of people have already lost their lives because of extreme weather events, because of crop failures and so on. So it's an emergency. You know, mm-hmm. how are we going to get out of this? I mean, ideally, we would stop emitting CO2. But first of all, that's not going to happen tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Secondly, even if we did do that, the longevity of CO2 in the atmosphere, the length of time it persists in the atmosphere before it's broken down, is so long. It's a matter of centuries mm-hmm. that it's not going to change tomorrow. Even if we were annihilated tomorrow, the whole human species, and so we couldn't emit mm-hmm. CO2, the atmosphere would still continue to be warm for many centuries. So that brings us to the geoengineering ideas. You know, what are we going to do about this? How are we going to artificially lower the temperatures again? So one idea is to suck CO2 out of the atmosphere, to remove it. I mean, that would be brilliant, wouldn't it? Forests already do that. Plants do that naturally through photosynthesis. Algae does that. But various people are looking at ways of speeding that natural process up. And another way of lowering the temperature is to reflect back the sun's heat. So not so much of it hits the Earth and gets trapped in the atmosphere by the carbon dioxide. So places that already do that naturally are big ice sheets. Mm-hmm. You know, they're very reflective. They're white, they're very reflective. We're reducing the number of those and their ability to do that. So people have had various ideas of increasing that. So one way is to perhaps plant light-coloured crops. Another one is to paint the roofs of buildings and cities white. There's various schemes. More outlandish ones are to put space mirrors to reflect the sun's, you know, in orbit, to reflect the sun's heat that way. I mean, these deserve serious consideration because it's such an emergency. I don't know if any of them are going to come to fruition, but we are already doing, to a certain extent, some of these things. You know, I met a guy who was painting a mountain white in Peru, I mean, which just seems like the sign of a very, very desperate person. And he is really desperate. You know, he's an alpaca farmer mm-hmm. whose glacier has disappeared on his mountain. It's melted. And that was the glacier that fed his alpaca pastures, watered his alpaca pastures. And without the pasture, without the water, the alpaca are dying and he will have to move. You mm-hmm. know, he will have to move to a city. But that's his village. You know, that's where his ancestors are buried. That's where he lives. That's where he wants to continue to live with his family. You know, what would they do in the city? They don't have the skills or the money to survive in a city. They would just end up being part of the great diaspora there. So he's painting his mountain white in the hope that the increased reflectivity of the mountain will help whatever precipitation falls there to freeze because it will be colder. He's having some success, apparently. How practical is that across the whole of the Andean chain? I don't know. I mean, at the moment, I would say, yeah, it's laughable. But, you know, we're going to have to seriously consider things like this if we're going to solve the problems that we're faced with, because these are planetary problems. You know, they're not just little local problems.
This is Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny and I'm talking to Gaia Vince, and we're talking about her book Adventures in the Anthropocene, A Journey to the Heart of the Planet We Made. And Guy, in the next two parts of the show, I want to look at the different natural features that you base the chapters around in the book. And I'm going to roughly split the two parts into wet stuff and dry stuff. So in the first part, we're going to talk about glaciers, rivers and oceans. You mentioned in the end of the first part, talking about geoengineering, the guy who was trying to paint the mountain to try and create an artificial glacier. And you meet somebody else who's got a different way of artificially creating glaciers where glaciers once were and have melted.
So in Ladakh, which is this incredibly beautiful part of the Himalayas, mm-hmm. it's actually in India, but it's a contested territory mm-hmm. between China, India, Pakistan. I mean, the people are Tibetan, so they mm-hmm. don't really fit in any of those categories. It's also a desert. It's a high altitude desert. Mm-hmm. They get very little precipitation, about the same as the Sahara. And the people that live there rely on glacier melt to water their crops. And without that, they don't have their one crop a year of usually barley to live on. So it's the glaciers are incredibly important there, and they're also melting. So I went there, and it's a beautiful place, but it's very hard to breathe because it's really, really high up. But obviously not hard to breathe for the people who live there because they've completely adapted to it. But from there, I actually met this retired railway engineer who had been working. He was in his 70s and he's been working in the sort of region for years. He started off as a railway engineer and then he helped with roads, road building and so on. And he kept coming across this big problem, you know, that the glaciers were melting. What are they going to do about water? And then one day when he was really, really almost oppressed by the problem, you know, he'd had a lot of people coming to him. And these are the clans across these mountains are actually very closely related. You know, everybody knows somebody from one village, even though the villages might be isolated. And while he was wrestling with this big problem, he noticed that a little pipe was leaking drips of water, and where it had dripped, where the stream of the drips had gone into a depression, a natural depression that happened to be in shadow because it was beneath a wall, they'd frozen and formed ice, whereas the rest of it was just soaked into the ground or had evaporated off. And from that, he came up with this idea that what he would do was create essentially artificial glaciers in the mountains near where the glaciers had originally been, but he would create them in the shadow of the mountain mm-hmm. because when the sun rises in the winter months, it barely makes it over the crest of some of these mountains. So he dug out, with the help of villagers, these shallow troughs. He created something to slow down precipitation, you know, little walls, culverts, little channels. And in that way, he managed to make these very shallow step-down pools in the shadow of the mountain. And the great thing is that because they're so high up and in the shadow, they melt, they froze mm-hmm. over the winter. And then when the sun peaked just across the ridge and hit the artificial glacier during April, it was at the perfect time mm-hmm. to melt the water for the fresh sowing of the seeds further down in the village. So it all worked really, really well. And what he's done is actually bring life back into these villages. He's made at least 12 now, I think perhaps more than that, since I spoke to him.
And these are quite big. I mean, a lot of glacier
they're enormous.
Big,
but they're not on the size of a glacier. And they're not comparable really to a glacier, because glaciers are metres thick, you know. They're these movable ice, huge, they're monsters of ice, glaciers. I mean, in comparison, it's nothing, but it's enough. It's water storage, and it's the size of, I guess you call it a lake, a frozen lake, shallow frozen lake. And it makes a huge difference, because people, they're actually experiencing in that region the warmer temperatures, in addition now to the artificial glaciers. So they're now able to sow many different crops. Before, they were restricted just to barley or perhaps to potatoes. But now they can grow things like tomatoes, because the temperature is so much higher there that they're able to grow different types of vegetables. And they were suffering this big problem of this unique and very beautiful community disappearing. I mean, they're very traditional. They still wear traditional clothes. They speak Ladakhi. It's a very sing-songy language. The women wear two plaits. I mean, it's It's a really beautiful tradition, and they were losing enormous numbers of people to Delhi or Mumbai because there was nothing for them there. And now people are actually coming back and the community feels a little bit stronger there. It's amazing what water can do.
One of the major causes of the global warming, of the atmosphere heating up, of course, has been our over-reliance on fossil fuels for energy. And one well-known, well-used green form of energy is hydroelectric power, using the power of rivers to generate energy. And so this is a really good idea. Nobody could have any sort of objections to this type of amazing green energy, could they?
Well, I mean, yes, it is. It is fantastic. And the reason, for example, that Norway has got pretty much zero emissions is because all its LNG is hydroelectric. Mm-hmm. And we're actually using that here in London. So it is a fantastic source of energy. It's one of our humanity's first sources of energy. But we are diverting rivers for farmland, but also for hydropower. We now control 3/4 of the world's water. There are almost no major rivers that actually run free now. Mm-hmm. We are channeling them, we're making them shallower, or we're digging them deeper. And it has enormous implications for sediment flow. So humans now control sediment flow, basically, on the planet, either through mining and other excavations, mm-hmm. or through the way that we have dammed up rivers or diverted rivers or put them into small channels. And that sediment flow is what maintains our coasts against the battering of the ocean. So there's big problems with that, but it also maintains the health of the river ecosystems and the marine ecosystems, mm-hmm. because that's how nutrients get from the top to the bottom, and how chemicals are managed and how water flows. It's really, really important. So sediment flow is one big problem with hydro dams. Another big problem is the fisheries. So there are a lot of migratory fish. I went to the Mekong in Laos, and that's one of the most important rivers on the planet for various reasons. I mean, that again starts in Tibet and ends in the South China Sea. And I picked it up in Thailand and went through various countries down to the end. And this is one of the rivers that's incredibly populated. An enormous number, millions of people depend on the river. They live on its banks and they depend on the fisheries. And it's the reason the fisheries there, the health of the fisheries, is one of the reasons why Cambodians, who are some of the poorest people on the planet, manage to have some of the best diet on the planet, because they eat so much good, healthy fish. Mm. And so the implications of damming the river are extreme for human health and poverty, as well as just the biodiversity. You know, mm-hmm. the Mekong catfish is the biggest freshwater fish. It's the size of a car. That would go extinct for sure if they dammed the river. And these upstream, downstream debates as well, you know, who's going to get the energy? Is it going to be the peasants living on the banks, or is it going to be the authoritarian one-party state mm-hmm. that owns the hydroelectric and it will sell it to China or sell it to Vietnam, you know? So this is what I mean by the very complex ways that we have to look at how we're mm-hmm. changing the planet. But from a human perspective, we have to look at the motivations and the benefits and the losses to the actual people there, as well as looking at the big changes. You know, if we change the Mekong River, we're making a fundamental change to planet Earth, because that's one of the major water sources. It's very important in the water cycle, the global water cycle. But we're also, you know, the reasons why we might change it are human reasons, mm-hmm. and the reasons why we might suffer from those changes are also human reasons. So we have to look at the interplay there, and I think it's really complex.
You mentioned there's a dam project in China where literally millions of people had to be moved, not even just affected down the length of a river, as you described with the Mekong, but cities were deluged and millions of people were uprooted. And damming the Mekong seems like a no-brainer. Don't do it. It seems like a bad idea. Much more complicated is a project you look at in Patagonia, which would actually probably only affect a few hundred people, would have to be uprooted and moved out of the way. But it would mean the destruction of like masses and masses of pristine wilderness. Tell us about that project.
So, yeah, in Patagonia is almost empty. It's one of the parts of the planet that is incredibly unpopulated. And for that reason, it's very precious to a lot of people, because we like the idea of a wilderness existing. a wilderness without humans. We like the idea of some big, vast nowhere land. Mm-hmm. And that's what Patagonia is. But Patagonia is, part of Patagonia is Chile. And Chile is this incredibly narrow, thin, long country, which starts, you know, at the southernmost inhabitable part, you know, Punta Arenas, which is the jumping off point for Antarctica. I mean, it's practically in Antarctica. And it goes all the way up the coast into the heat of the Atacama Desert, the driest, driest region. And the people live on the coast, and they live in the capital, but most of the wealth for the country comes from the mining concessions in the desert, where there's absolutely no water. And with the Andean glaciers melting, you know, there really is no water there. And mining is incredibly energy and water intensive. So the idea was to get the energy from hydroelectric projects where there is a lot of water in Patagonia, where they have these great gushing glacial rivers, and send it on electric cables thousands of kilometres north to the desert, to the capital, Santiago, and to the desert. And interestingly, Chile is this country where a lot of expats with environmental leanings call home. So the guy that runs Patagonia, for example, the clothing company, lives there. Mm-hmm. And these people have a lot of sway. They have a lot of political sway, and they have a lot of international sway. So it's kind of been this interesting debate between these green groups and these green individuals and people from around the world who claim Patagonia as important, as of global importance, as their global back garden that they don't want to see trashed. And the more sort of prosaic government who wants to make money for energy, wants to make energy to bring the actual poor populace up into a developed country. There's actually been a regime change recently, and the current president, she's actually ruled against the dams. So it now looks like the dams won't be built. But mm-hmm. I think this is a really, really interesting case. I mean, it's the first that I know of where such an economically viable project has actually been ruled against for environmental reasons. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really interesting, the reasons why. Because, as you say, in China, the Three Gorges Dam, and that's just one of the many, many projects that the Chinese government has enacted, which mm-hmm. have involved uprooting, you know, millions of people from homes, getting rid of entire cities, deluging massive landscapes of, again, international importance. So for Patagonia to have gone that way, I think is really, really interesting. I mean, of course, there are always alternatives. You know, the Atacama Desert is prime for solar power. And, mm-hmm. and actually, Chile is investing in solar power there. But it's also, you know, wind power and geothermal. I mean, there are so many options there. But the easiest and the cheapest would have been to do this hydroelectric thing. So I think it's really interesting that they haven't done that.
I'm Natalie Haynes. You're listening to Resonance FM. And this is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
The next situation we're going to talk about is a case where a regime change hasn't helped out the environment, unfortunately. It's rather a sad story. And we've come to oceans now, but I want to talk about the Maldives, which is really on the front line of rising oceans. It's somewhere that is, without a doubt, going to disappear in the future. It's a serious population of people that will need to be, you know, somehow need to deal with this problem. And the president of the Maldives, well, unfortunately isn't any longer, which we'll talk about, but was a remarkable man. Or he still is a remarkable man, he's just no longer the president.
Yeah, so Mohamed Nasheed is one of the most incredible individuals I've met. I mean, he was a human rights activist and a lawyer, a journalist for many years. And he came to power in the Maldives with this kind of agenda to completely transform it in the face of almost unavoidable loss of the entire island. And it's not just the Maldives that's suffering this. There are the whole of the Pacific Islanders. These are very low-lying atolls. So Maldives are suffering two main effects of our putting CO2 into the atmosphere. So the carbon dioxide is warming the planet and causing the oceans to expand. So the sea levels are rising, and also the glaciers are melting. So that's also causing the sea levels to rise. So it's a very, very low-lying country. So even a tiny rise in sea level risks inundating the entire islands. Mm-hmm. And as soon as there's a storm surge or anything like that, you know, they were the worst hit per capita by the tsunami of 2003. They really, really are living at sea level. Mm-hmm. But the other problem that they're facing is the fact that the oceans are absorbing the carbon dioxide. So they're warming, but they're also becoming more acidic because it turns to carbonic acid. And the Maldives is actually made entirely of coral. So, you know, when we dig down in Britain, there's mud and rock. You dig down in the Maldives, it is just coral. The whole thing, it's an atoll. So it formed over millions of years. And the land is just coral. And coral is calcium carbonate, and it just dissolves. It completely dissolves in more acidic oceans. And its protection, which is living reef, the coral that's living, it can't grow, it can't build its skeleton because it's being eroded faster than it can build up. It requires so much energy when the oceans are that acidic. And the warmer oceans are causing the coral to die, because another thing about coral is that it depends for its food on these algae that it hosts. These algae live inside it. And when it gets too hot, the water gets too hot, the coral just expels the algae. And so then it just starves. So that's what you see when you see these bleaching events, because the colour comes from the algae. So in the face of this terrible doom and gloom, Nasheed, actually, the president of the Maldives, actually came to this problem with this kind of gung-ho attitude that we need to act against climate change globally, and we need to be an example. You know, even if it's too late to save the Maldives, we need to be an example. We need to do everything in, we need to produce our energy not from oil. We need to produce it in a green way. We need to produce everything in a green way. We need to deal with our waste. We need to be paragons of this new world to show that it's possible. If this very poor country can do it, then everyone else can do it. And at the same time, he's left with this incredibly practical problem of what on earth he's going to do. Because, I mean, we're not talking hundreds of years from now. We're talking maybe 20, 30, 40 years from now. Most of the Maldives is going to be uninhabitable. And there's people living there, schools, you know, hospitals. What are they going to do? And it's the same problem faced by, say, Kiribati. Mm-hmm. So his solution is to build up a sovereign fund. And the Maldives is a great sort of honeymoon destination. Mm-hmm. It's an upper-end holiday destination. So people pay incredible amounts of money to stay there. And so his idea is to use that money to buy a plot of land elsewhere in another country and put all his people there. I mean, I don't know how this is going to work out logistically, because buying land, making a country in someone else's land, mm-hmm. is fraught with difficulties. I mean, look at the Israeli-Palestinian mm-hmm. problem, for example. I mean, the president of Kiribati has, he thinks, bought some land now in Fiji for his people. I mean, it's hard to know how that's going to play out. Again, you know, Kiribati is a democracy. Fiji is not anymore. So these are very real problems that people are facing right now, and they're trying to deal with them in different ways. And they are, again, these are planetary problems.
And I mentioned that Mohamed Nasheed has been deposed. Basically, there's another president who's a relative of the former dictator, so presumably does not look so kindly on these environmental issues. So what's happening now? What's the sort of story with the Maldives right now?
Yeah, well, it's not great. I get in my inbox every day stories of more human rights abuses that are going on in the Maldives. I mean, that was something that Nasheed was very, very firm about, that he released all political prisoners. Human rights was the core stone of his environmental practice, because, you know, if you don't look after the human, you can't even start looking after the human's environment. That was his thoughts on those matters. I mean, there was a coup, there was a semi sort of democratic election, which Nasheed lost. The current president is fairly autocratic, yes. And I don't know what's going to happen in the future. I mean, when I spoke to Nasheed last, he's carrying on campaigning. He's hoping to move things on, and that he will get a chance again to carry on with these really important projects. But at the moment, investors pulled out, everything was put on hold, really. So it's a what could have been story rather than isn't this great, unfortunately. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny, and I'm talking to Gaia Vince, and we're talking about her book Adventures in the Anthropocene. And Gaia, we've spent the second part of the show talking about wet stuff. One of the themes all the way through the book is the importance, obviously, and the scarcity now of water, of drinking water. Another thing that is massively consumptive of water is agriculture. So let's talk about farmland, about how has agriculture changed the face of the planet in the Anthropocene?
Well, this is one of the most human landscapes again. I mean, I mentioned cities were a human mm-hmm. landscape. Farmland is as well. I mean, these vast monocultures that we plant, they don't even exist naturally. Mm-hmm. These are plants that have been bred over thousands of years to be a completely different plant, to be the sort of plant that makes it easy to harvest and for us to get the most nutrition from. So the point is that farmlands replace or displace wildlands. So we're having a massive effect on mm-hmm. natural ecosystems just because we're creating our own artificial ones. There are some parts, especially of Europe and the United States, where the entire landscape is so artificial you don't get any sense of what was there before. Mm-hmm. They displace forests, they displace natural savanna, they displace sometimes desert, and are very necessary. You know, we need farmlands to eat, but at the same time, we are disturbing ecosystems. We're causing an extinction in many other creatures that would otherwise use that landscape. So, I mean, I'm not making a valued judgment about farmlands or about any of these things, really. I'm just sort of drawing attention to the fact that we have massively changed our planet. I mean, 40% of the Earth's ice-free land surface is now used to create food for us. That's just one species. That's just for humans.
And in the short term, that could only increase. The population is increasing. The history of agriculture has been a history of depletion of nitrogen, I guess, is the obvious thing. Various points of the history of agriculture are we seem to reach a point where we're not going to be able to feed the growing world population, and then, you know, we discover artificial fertilisers, and then we discover, you know, the Haber-Bosch process, and then we discover, you know, the agricultural revolution. Where is this going? What are we going to have to do to feed the ever-growing population in the future?
Well, this is the big problem. And what we need to do is to produce more food on less land. Otherwise, it's completely unsustainable. I mean, as it is, we already waste or throw away 40% of the food that we create. So in the West, we throw away the food after it's got to our plate, usually. In the poor world, 40% is lost due to either transport problems or disease. So we need to step up the way we're producing food. And one of the biggest problems is that we are producing food for animals to feed ourselves rather than directly eating the crops that grow on the land. Mm-hmm. So cattle, for example, are a terribly inefficient way of using land. Where are we going to get our protein from? I mean, at the moment, there is a substantial proportion of the human population that's malnourished. It doesn't have enough protein. And if we're going to produce a human population which reaches its potential in brain capacity, for example, then children need to have a decent amount of protein. Mm-hmm. So we need to look for alternative sources, because it's just not sustainable for every child in Africa, every child in India, every child in China to have, you know, three steaks a week. It's just, that's not going to work. So there are alternatives. Insect farms, for example, that's one of the most, probably the most efficient way of producing protein. Mm-hmm. Animal protein for our diet. Insects are eaten around the world. I've had insects. They're very tasty. Also, most of our food is processed, so, you know, you might have an icky, yucky factor with insects, but, you know, you're not eating the insects. I mean, what does soy taste like? Mm-hmm. You know, nothing, but it's in everything. We're perfectly capable of flavouring things and treating them so that they taste in whatever way fashion deems acceptable for us to eat. So insects, farmed fish. I mean, most fish is already farmed now. We need to look at the way we're producing crops, perhaps use genetically modified crops, which are more drought resistant, which can grow to produce nutrients that are missing from a lot of people's diets. So, for example, in Africa, vitamin A is missing from a lot of the food that they eat. That can lead to blindness. It's a leading cause of blindness in lots of areas. We need to really rethink the way we're producing food in the Anthropocene, and it can't be a one-size-fits-all model. There is no right answer, and we all have to go out and do that. We're going to have to use all the resources that we have, all the different techniques that we've mastered over centuries, over millennia, actually, of farming. I mean, some people think, we were talking earlier about the signs of the Anthropocene and where it might start. Some people think that the big landscape changes that we made when we learnt to farm maybe 8,000 years ago are so profound that we should date the Anthropocene from then. I don't know if that's true. Now it's become global, but it certainly wasn't global then. But it's true that we do know a lot about how to feed ourselves now, and we need to pull that knowledge, and we need to bring it together and make sure that at the moment we don't have this ridiculous divide where a large proportion of the population is incredibly obese and another proportion is malnourished. You know, we should be able to find a happy medium by now.
I want to move us on to forests, and I guess more specifically the lack of forest, deforestation, which is a huge problem all around the world. And why are forests important? And when I say forests, we're talking about, you know, rainforests and obviously more higher latitude type forests as well. But why do we need forests?
Well, first of all, they're lovely. It's really nice to walk in a forest. They are incredibly important for the planet in so many ways. They are very, very rich. The tropical forests are one of the richest, most biodiverse ecosystems in the world. So they support an enormous diversity of species. They're also incredibly important for various chemical cycles. So the carbon cycle, the water cycle, they clean the air, they oxygenate it. That amount of photosynthetic activity, that amount of leaves sucking in carbon dioxide, producing oxygen and water, that's actually so enormous that it changes the cycle, the way that the cycling of those chemicals on a planetary scale. The water cycle, again, it's really important. So when we're talking about geoengineering, we're talking about ways of cooling the planet. Well, forests already do a lot of that job for us, and that's why they're so important. The forests on the Earth, but also the forests of the oceans, the phytoplankton of the oceans, doing that job for us. And some of them are almost at tipping point. That's the problem, because if a forest like the Amazon gets too dry, then trees start to die, and it tips the balance from wet tropical forest towards desert, and it's a cascade effect, and it can happen really quickly. And that's the big worry, really, because if we were to lose the Amazon, that would have an enormous effect globally.
I'm Irving Finkel, and you're listening to Resonance FM, and this is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
Let's talk about one of the other remarkable people that you met on the journey. This is Bolivian Amazon, and this is a woman, Rosa Maria Ruiz. So tell us her remarkable story.
Well, she's an Amazonian warrior. I mean, she's absolutely incredible. She started off tin mining, or I don't know if it was tin, probably silver mining, in one of those dirt poor communities that they have all over the centre of South America, in Bolivia. And she got to know the community. Well, she lived among the community there, and so she spoke the local language, and She travelled around and had quite a hard childhood. So she's an incredible woman. She immediately saw the value of the Amazon, not just the forest and the biodiversity, but also the local communities, the indigenous people that live there. And she learnt several of the languages. And she had this dream to set up a bioreserve, because at the time, the dictatorship, the government there, was basically destroying the Amazon as fast as it could, setting up mines, setting up hydroelectric plants. It was looking bad for some of the most precious parts of the Amazon. So she tried to set up a huge reserve, and she got international publicity for this, and she was quite successful briefly before the government got wind of the whole project and realised that actually it was going to lose out financially because it wasn't able to make good on its mines and so on. And her life was in danger. I mean, there were several assassination attempts. There was an arson attack. Her whole kind of eco resort based in the jungle was burnt down, almost killing about, I think, four or five people who were there, including children. And despite all this, she got through it and she came back to a different government, actually. There was the South America's, the continent's first indigenous president, Evo Morales, took office and he gave her a little bit of land and she's built her own reserve there. And I went to visit her there and it is a totally trashed area of land that she's cleaned up. She's rehabilitating a lot of animals. And yeah, I mean, she's been attacked by caiman. She's lost a leg. I mean, she's just quite a remarkable woman.
At the beginning of the show, we talked about the geoengineering ideas and you briefly alluded to this, but there are people that are creating artificial forest, basically this idea of artificial trees which can be used to scrub the carbon dioxide out of the air. So tell us briefly about that idea.
Well, so photosynthesis does this naturally, but the ultimate aim in photosynthesis is to benefit the tree, is to get the most nutrients to the tree. It's not to take the most carbon dioxide out or to get the most energy out. So we should be better, and there are better solar cells that are more efficient than tree leaves, and there are better ways of absorbing carbon dioxide. So people are trying this in various labs around the world to a greater or lesser extent, and the idea is to build essentially artificial forests which would filter the air and remove the carbon dioxide, and then they could just be rinsed and it would all start again. So at the moment, the efficiency isn't that great and the cost is still very high. But these are artificial constructs. Mm. Cost is an artificial construct. We decide what's worth paying for and what is not worth paying for. So, you know, ultimately, we do have some solutions that could work for this. And I think the next decade will be extremely exciting in this area. I really think that we're going to come up with something, you know.
We're nearly finished, but at this point, I guess the normal question to ask you would be, you know, what can be done? What should we be doing? It's a ridiculously big and an unwieldy and unfair question to ask. So I want to say instead, what's the sort of main takeaway point from the book? If people read this book, what do you want them to go away from it with?
An awareness of our power. I mean, we are really, really remarkable. We are changing a planet. And that's quite phenomenal. But also, we're incredibly ingenious. I mean, all these stories, they're of these incredible people, these really remarkable people, but they're remarkable partly for who they are, of course, but also because of the circumstances that they've been thrust into, essentially. I mean, they're living at an extraordinary time, but we're all living at that time, and there are remarkable people among us. I hope that we take from that some sort of inspiration.
So that's been Adventures in the Anthropocene, A Journey to the Heart of the Planet We Made, by Gaia Vince, and it's out now from Chatter and Windows Books. So, Gaia, thank you so much for coming in and telling us about it.
Thank you, it's been great.
You've been listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by Neil Denny and was broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM.
You can find the Little Atoms podcast on iTunes, and you can follow the show on Twitter at Little Atoms.
If you'd like to donate a little money to support the show, you can do so at littleatoms.com. Thanks for listening.